Okay, so our next speaker is Colin Cowrie, and he's going to be talking about partnering on CropWow relative research at three scales, commonalities for success. And Colin is, I'm happy to welcome him to the USDA ARS. He's officially started Sunday, so he'll be a postdoc in my lab half-time and then also continuing to work at SEOT. So, Colin, take it away.
Good afternoon. So thanks for the opportunity to present a couple of different projects that I've been involved in, actually two of which are connected to the projects that were mentioned in Peter and Karen's last two presentations. This talk is a little bit different, I think, than the last two. It's a little bit of a thought piece, and it's purposely that way because, it's focused on the collaborations and partnerships we developed, but really trying to think through what's been useful and maybe what hasn't. And I'll try to be honest about that, but it's actually to engender hopefully a little bit of a conversation, and I'd appreciate actually your thoughts and disagreements or whatever if you have them. And to start that out as a thought piece, there's a journalist that got in touch with me recently that has been in touch over the years a little bit, and she asked, you know, what's going on with CropWow relatives these days? Like what, 5 years, 10 years ago we weren't hearing about them, and yet now they're all over the media. And Laura Merrick, who's spoken a couple of times here in the last presentations, is the featured collector right there at the bottom of that picture. And it was an interesting question for me. Like, what is going on with CropWow relatives? And I didn't have a ready answer to that. And so I have some thoughts now, and perhaps you can add some to it. But, I mean, hopefully the first answer is, of course, that they are interesting and useful species. And the last two presenters have made that case, certainly. And I don't think I need to make that anymore. But there's certainly good historical use, and there's increasing ideas that not only for pest and disease resistance, but for other traits like what climate change adaptability traits, that these species could have some real use. There was a study that just looked at publications and over decades, and certainly over decades, the number of publications about the use of CropWow relatives have gone up. My apologies for the very small text at the end, but it basically says that in percentages of citations over the last four decades or so, every decade we get more and more publications about CropWow relatives. And as I think Peter mentioned, the pest and disease resistance is still certainly the core of that use. But what else is going on with CropWow relatives besides them being neat and interesting and useful? There's a bunch of activity about information generation and then information accessibility, I think. And so botanists and taxonomists have been working on who these species are, of course, for many centuries. There's been more recent efforts about getting that information online and available to people. And these are two that are about who the species are and how they're related to the crops. One is the USDA AgrIn effort that's successful and online. If you just go to GRIN and then you look kind of on the left, it says CropWow relatives in GRIN or something like that. You click on there and you can search through just for CropWow relatives. It's been up for a couple of years now. And then a connected related effort, which the first speaker spoke about, is something similar more on the global level that's called the Harlan and DeWitt CropWow relative inventory. So maybe this is generating some more information and excitement about CropWow relatives. On the data side, on the other side, there's certainly a mobilization of data about where these species are. And that's the mobilization of herbarium data and germplasm data through big portals like JSTOR and like GBIF. And again, Genesis, which is that final one, which is really looking at germplasm. So these sort of information can tell us where are these species in the wild, where can you go to herbaria and gene banks and find the material to do some research. And then the final Genesis can also tell us if you want germplasm, where might you go to to find that and access it. This is not a shameless plug, hopefully, but maybe there's also been some information that's been generated or excitement that has to do with more recent studies about how are we doing in terms of how comprehensive our conservation systems are ex situ. There's been a couple of papers, there's been a lot of pretty maps generated that I think has been in the press. So maybe that's had a little bit, and I'll come back to this in a minute. There has been some work on what I'm sort of now calling predictive characterization, which is for wild species, if you want to know what they might be useful as genetic resources, well, what kind of information can you use before you dig in there and do crossings and start to evaluate that might be helpful? And perhaps looking at where these species come from in terms of their climates, their niches, their soils may give us some indication. That's been evolving over time, and it's sort of ramping up. There's a couple of examples on the left. Figs is quite a good example. There's been a lot of publication about that. And then, of course, on the other side, the increasing amount of genetic and now genotypic data, and, of course, the connection between that data and breeding has ramped up sort of the use of genetics in estimating how these species might be more useful. So the whole point of this, a lot of generation of information and accessibility of information. I'll come back to whether that information is really robust and how useful and what the vulnerabilities are. And then there's also been some work about making the germplasm more accessible itself. The left I put up in as an example, this is again GRIN, and this is more secondhand through colleagues, but I understand that when GRIN was sort of revamped and made more easily searchable, the amount of germplasm also requested through the USDA system went way up. So we're about to embark, hopefully quite soon, on another kind of major redo of the information system for our germplasm in the United States, and it'll be interesting to see if it again jumps up in the requests and interest. So that's just providing an information system where people sort of can figure out what they want and what they're looking for and ask for it. On the other side, we now have more clear international agreements about the exchange and access to germplasm. I put that question mark up there because whether that is actually then generated actually sort of more momentum and more access, I think is still perhaps still in question. But we do have the mechanisms there, and they're more clear. Again, at the end of this, if you have responses to this, I'd really appreciate it. Just a couple of other things. Perhaps crop wild relatives have become more interesting or more momentum because there's a bit more awareness now that we have increasing and increasingly challenging problems with the big question of how we're going to feed people in the future, given less resources and more people, changing dietary expectations, maybe less water, less phosphorus, these issues. So where do you go? One part is sustainable intensification through genetic resources. And on the flip side of that, we have more awareness about the threats to crop wild relatives. These are examples from Brazil, deforestation, the transition to industrial agricultural systems, urbanization. This is one population, the last population of a wild peanut on the left there, bottom left, and climate change impacts. And these are not just issues of developing countries like Brazil. These are issues at home with listed species now that certainly, but I would argue, need some focus by folks like the second presenter is really working on in situ conservation as well as connecting that to the ex situ. So my argument is a lot is going on, and a lot of information generation, a lot of maybe awareness, and crop wild relatives are in this sweet spot perhaps at this moment, and who knows how long that will go on, but they're here for now, and they connect to these big terms that we're thinking about a lot in the media, certainly, food and nutrition security, as indirect contributors through genetic resources, agricultural development, and climate change adaptation, and then as wild species, also connected to being indirect ecosystem services and being biodiversity conservation issues. And those are connected to at least, as I count them, three major international agreements that are powerful and that people are thinking. the United States has yet to sign on to a couple of these, but hopefully there will be some more engagement with them. Yeah. So that's the positive side. Like, there's a lot going on, and we've got mobility and motion. There's also a lot that still needs to be done, is the argument, and there are very basic questions still for a lot of these species. The who is who are these species, and there's definitely gaps in that taxonomy and gaps in understanding the relation with crops. The where, and I'll get back to this in a few minutes, is also errors in our available information on where these species live, and also what's in our gene banks and what's not in our gene banks. The what is actually maybe the biggest question, which is, so what is really useful about these species, and how do we really figure that out? The predictive characterization that I mentioned before, using climate data and soil data, is moving along, but there's a lot to do to figure out how to do that well, and it's been very rarely validated in the field as to whether that's... If you find out that a particular crop wild relative comes from a particular soil and you're looking for that as a trait to breed in, whether it actually has that sort of that trait and how accessible that trait is in breeding. And the how, of course, is that there's a bunch of different questions about how you conserve complicated species, both ex situ and in situ. And in the ex situ side, tend to be species that don't produce a lot of seed in some cases, difficult to store in other cases, and difficult to regenerate, for instance. There's the access issues, which I mentioned, the political issues across countries. There's a general decline in public research funding, which is a challenge. Luckily, we have global projects that are investing sort of more on the global level now. And then the management authority is more about the in situ side, but crop wild relatives are these wild species, and so agricultural programs don't typically, or haven't in the past, typically focused on them, I think, as main focus. You know, they're wild species, mostly kind of out here in their peripheral genetic resources. But because they're often weedy kind of species that aren't often also listed endangered species, they're not often also the primary focus of wildlife or a biodiversity organization. So sometimes they fall in between the cracks, sort of those two management authorities. And perhaps that's exactly why projects like the second speaker spoke about are really neat, sort of putting those two together and filling that crack. And on the use side, of course, there's the challenges. This is what I understand, at least in peanut, as a fairly typical example of the use of wild relatives for root knot nematode resistance. And the argument, it's simply to overwhelm you with the complication that it takes at least 10 years, a bunch of different crosses and a bunch of different back crosses to make something useful out of this. That's a lot of work. And it's not high tech, but it's definitely savvy and it takes some investment and energy. And then there's this quote that we like to use, which is simply that it's not so simple what you get with these crosses. It's a bit like crossing a house cat with a wild cat. You don't automatically get a big docile pussycat. What you get is a lot of wildness you probably don't want lying on your sofa. So I finally come to the projects I've been involved in and the collaborations to try to address a few of those problems. I assume that I don't actually have ability to move the camera, but the screen has kind of moved over to the right a little bit. And I'm not sure what to do about that besides move the laptop, which I assume is going to do nothing. But anyway, the screen is a little bit that way. If you shoved it that way, it would show the entire world. Oh, thank you. Thanks, Jorge. Solutions like this is what I think we need in crop biorelatives. So this is the result of about 5 years of trying to put together occurrence data on crop biorelatives around the world for... many thousands of species related to 100 or so crops. Why I want to talk about this a little bit is that it required an intensive and huge amount of collaborations and partnerships across the world, and there was some, I think, hopefully maybe a few lessons learned. But the main sort of overview of what was done was the gathering of close now to 20 million records That's why it took 5 years. It's focused on 193 genera that are basically the closely related genera to our main important food crops around the world. We did quite a bit of work to standardize that data across and to validate both the taxonomy and the geography information within it. It's basically a truly global database, and almost all of it is openly accessible to the public and will be very soon accessible through GBIF and other media that are quite easy to search. How do we do this? So the idea was basically to grab all the information across the world we essentially could. And so that was through these sources like GBIF and JSTOR that are already online and have quite a lot of information. It was through contacting the major herbaria and gene banks around the world and other researchers and basically asking and asking to gather that information. A little bit of research, a little bit of literature as well. The main method was basically to annoy people by emailing them so much that they'd eventually give the data. If you're in the crowd, well, you are. There's quite a few people in the crowd that were involved in that. My apologies and my thanks at the same time for that. There was, a useful technique of capitalizing on pre-existing contacts and relationships that we had through partners like the Global Crop Diversity Trust and the USDA to basically say, we know these folks and maybe we're a trustworthy organization to gather this data. We provided data sharing options that included a formal relationship agreement with the Global Crop Diversity Trust and SIA in terms of sharing that information. I'll get back to that in a minute. And a number of, let's say, perks with sharing that involved giving them their data back, hopefully in a bit of a value-added format, training opportunities, and collaborative publications. That resulted in, a bunch of partners. I'll just read the very end. 90 direct providers to us, perhaps about 500 total providers that we're listing as been part of this global database now. Now getting a little bit more into maybe the more interesting parts about the collaborations. This data sharing agreement we put out to everybody if they wanted to be part of that is to have a formal sort of agreement on paper with us about the data. It was interesting that that not many providers actually really cared that much, it seems like, to have a formal agreement about sharing data with us. Five. And only two of those wanted within that you could only share the data like to us but not beyond us. And so that was interesting. And then 11 of the total 90 providers did say, look, you can use this data, but we would prefer that you didn't share it with the rest of the world. And there was a number of reasons for that. One was because of some endangered species and other listed species within that that was just mentioned before. There was others where they'd already gotten the data through agreements that those agreements said you can't share the data too much beyond. And there were some folks that were worried about their own publishing and intellectual property within that. But this actually filtered out over those years of the project, and by the end, almost everybody, essentially, it came down to, I think, only about three providers now have said, it's fine, go ahead, share the data across as much as you like. So over 19 million records that are openly shareable. So what are sort of my lessons learned about this? Superficially, overall, asking for all this data and asking for a little bit of time of people has been a very positive experience, with people very excited about sharing with this project. Basically, if people had data and they wanted to respond, then they shared it with us. I think that those previous connections and then some investment in creating connections with people was helpful through that. This is a tricky wording. Although a few providers from closely related organizations did not collaborate, this was interesting to us. Those folks that ended up being the most difficult or didn't share data and collaborate in the end were not the ones that we did not know. In fact, they were some of the ones that were closest to us as organizations, and that was a surprise to me. I could talk about what my thoughts are on that, but I'll just leave it there for now. And I think that definitely these sort of mutually beneficial relationships did help with the sharing data. But overall, the most important thing for most providers was simply to have attribution and recognition, and that's it. A quick photo of some of the trainees that were involved. They data shared, and then we trained them in sort of data processing and management, as well as doing the gap analysis that I'll mention in a minute. And there's I like to show this picture just on the right because this guy, who's also the guy sitting on the top left, was also trained. He'd never been on a trampoline before, and he was just incredible. And he also did like front flips and back flips on his very first time on a trampoline. So I was pretty impressed by that. Mikey, who will be speaking next, is also one of these trainees. Okay, so finally, what are we going to do with this data, and how does that relate to the collaborations and providers? One thing, we've provided all this information back to the original providers, hopefully in a value-added form. As we provide it out to the rest of the world, it's going out under a Creative Commons licensing, and that so far has seemed to be acceptable to, well, everybody that we put the email out to, that's been fine. We've also provided quite a bit of data directly to people who have requested it, at least 20 organizations so far, and there's some listing of how you might access the data right now. This presentation will be up online, so you can get that. And we're also working to make the variety of tools to process that data also available as packages to data managers, essentially. Project number two is the gap analysis project, which is taking all this data and then trying to understand from it, well, where do these species live in the world, and how are we doing in terms of their representation in gene banks? And we did that as a crop-by-crop approach. There's four listed here, the pigeon pea, sweet potato, sunflower, potato, but it was done for many different crops. And I'll take you through our methodology very quickly and then focus again on the partnerships created and what happened that was useful, I think. So the first thing that we did was choose who we were going to focus on and then gather that data, and I already mentioned what we did there. The next thing was processing that data, which is really checking out its taxonomy and its geography and making sure it's as robust as possible, and then taking that and creating estimated models of where we think the species live based on that occurrence data, based on where that species has been found in the past and its similarities in terms of climate and soils around the world. And finally, from there, we can understand, in terms of where a species is entirely in the world, where we already collected and conserved it in gene banks, and do what's called a gap analysis, which is figure out where we have not yet collected it and sort of estimate, well, perhaps those are the places that we need to go if we want a fully comprehensive representation of those species in gene banks. And we can come up even with maps of, well, this is where we have not yet collected yet, in this case for wild beans, and these are sort of the hot spots in central Mexico and Jalisco that would be the number one spot if you wanted to collect wild beans that we have not yet collected. In many of these steps, it wasn't just a couple of sort of data geeks doing this. It involved quite a lot of iterations with those who really understood who the species are, where they live, what their breeding issues, and all of that. And that was sort of a daily a reminder for me of how much actually, no matter how good these methods get, I think of modeling and processing, that this expertise is invaluable. And it's a concern because this expertise, I think, is disappearing in the world as these experts get older and retire. This is just another crop example of the models that we come up with. These are the wild relatives of pigeon pea. There's about 15. They occur in Southeast Asia across to Australasia, and there's kind of two main hot spots that you can come up with where these species occur in sort of density or concentration. The prioritization of these species, it looks a little bit wild, but it's really quite simple. If the species are over in the red, then they're highly under-conserved in gene banks. If you head towards the green, they're doing pretty well. So in terms of the wild relatives of pigeon pea, there's a lot left to do there. The black is our final assessment in terms of our gap analysis, the data processing of where that species rests. But these triangles are also interesting. Those triangles are what our experts told us, and sort of a mean across four experts here of what they thought were the priorities for these species. And you can see that some line up pretty well, and there was some disagreement there, and that was very helpful, I think, for our process. Actually, more than helpful. That was critical to our process. We took a couple of additional steps that I'll just mention very quickly, which were about this predictive characterization. And these are each of these colors, these sort of what do you call this, sort of impressionistic colors of, these are the wild relatives, their niches in terms of where they occur in rainfall, in precipitation and temperature. The boxes you see are the crop's basic niche, as we understand it. And so we start to get an indication from this sort of work of where, which species and what traits they might have that could be useful in terms of genetic resources. And then you can map things like that. So this is the occurrence of these wild relatives of pigeon pea that have not been collected and occur in regions with less than 500 millimeters of rainfall. That's actually quite drought tolerant for pigeon pea sort of germplasm. And so these might be good areas to go collecting if you really want drought tolerant wild relatives of pigeon pea. We did that for 81 crops. We focused on these 28, 29 crops of relevance to this global project that Peter mentioned. It turned out, and this is sort of the main finding, that I guess it's really just a repeat in a sense, essence of what I said. It really took a huge amount of iterative work with the experts to get to a point where the data was good enough to really feel confident in it and pass it over. And these publications, these five, I would say, were really our best work because they involved so much iterative back and forth that we figured we might as well put it out there as a product for the rest of the world to look at as well. So these are online. There's one for lettuce. There's one for sunflower now. There's one for sweet potato, for pigeon pea, and for potato. Finally, and very quickly, because this is sort of just beginning to ramp up, we've done some work on the national level of trying to understand how we're doing with our ex situ collections in the United States and Canada and Australia. And I think Karen actually did a good job of already mentioning our work of listing the species in the United States. So I'll just skip over that for now. But essentially, we've been listing species in the United States. and now the next step of those species is really to try to understand how well they're collected and conserved in the national system, and start working more collaboratively with the crop curators, with our colleagues, to help fill those gaps. The sort of a preliminary assessment on a very quick note is that we have a lot left to do to fill the gaps. That's not to say, though, that there hasn't been a huge amount of work already done. But we got a bit more to go. Those red dots are just simply to show that in every state in the United States, there's gaps in our collections in terms of wild relatives that are not fully collected and conserved. So two final slides that are just to generate perhaps a little bit of thought or discussion that are sort of my thoughts about the last 5 years and these collaborations and relationships and maybe what's been useful. Number one, not a surprise, I think, but a wonderful finding that I think the plant genetic resources community, combined with taxonomists, breeders, the sort of larger crop science community that we contacted, were really positive about working and sharing data. And that has made the whole world to the success of the project. The personal relationships and using the pre-existing relationships were also, I think, helpful in sort of facilitating that. This data sharing agreement, these sort of formal agreements, are actually not that desired or used. Overall, the data is really very openly available. Not that many people didn't want to do that. And the Creative Commons license of basically just attributing data and nothing else seems to be acceptable to almost everybody. Recognition, though, is the most important thing. People definitely want to be recognized for their work, which is substantial. Finally, we're still, despite all this effort in the beginning that I mentioned of getting stuff online and working, we're very far from having standardized data that's easy to collect and pull down and use without the use of especially these experts who really know what this data means, who these species are, where these species really live, where the errors are. And so what do we do about the retiring and the moving on of these two experts? And I think I basically say that in this next point. Absolutely necessary. It's taken a lot of iterations back and forth with them to do that. These publications were really useful to move on with that. So my feeling is that this sort of approach of being of open access and sharing data is definitely the way forward in what's happening, becoming even expected, I'd say, definitely expect it at CIOT, where I work now, where all of our data after 1 year of a project has to be open access and available to everyone. And a final note, which I didn't mention in this talk, is that my experience with media is that they're dying to hear about crop bioRelatives, and a lot of interest. It's simply being proactive about your research and what you're doing and getting in touch with journalists and such, or at least being willing to talk to research to journalists. And it's often sort of intimidating, but it's well appreciated. So thanks very much for your time.